the San Francisco Experience podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 26, Episode 16. Day of Reckoning: How the Far Right Declared War on Democracy. Talking with author Mike Wendling of the BBC. Hello, Mike, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
With Donald Trump having wrapped up the Republican nomination for president, the last official step in his reascension as the party leader will be the Republican convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, July 15th to the 18th. And a key part of his campaign this year, as in 2016 and 2020, will be the Make America Great Again movement, or MAGA. MAGA is poised for a massive rebound on the American political stage. What is it, and how has the 2024 version of MAGA evolved after 4 years on the sidelines? How has it changed, and what role will MAGA play in Donald Trump's campaign? The movement remains a powerful force in American politics. In the wake of the 2022 midterm elections, an estimated 4 in 10 Republicans identified themselves as MAGA Republicans. Our guest today is Mike Wendling, U.S. digital reporter for BBC News. He joins us from his office in Chicago. Hi, Mike, and welcome to the show.
Hello.
Mike, I should say welcome back. Mike, please tell us about your responsibilities as U.S. digital reporter for BBC News. Many of our listeners will remember your previous role as editor and host of BBC Trending, the social media disinformation program that we all listened to on the BBC World Service.
Yeah, well, you know, in some ways, my job here in the U.S. is not so different from that role. Only the kinds of things that I was covering in terms of disinformation, extremism, I get to do it sort of up close and personal rather than flying in from time to time. I cover, this kind of stuff, also more general news and conventional politics from a perspective that includes what's happening online, what's happening in organizing in terms of mainstream parties, but also fringe groups. I'm writing mostly for the BBC News website, though I do also pop up on radio and TV still from time to time. It's pretty exciting, and obviously it's a pretty exciting time to be a journalist here in the United States in an election year. Quite an important election year from what everybody says. It's also interesting to be based here in Chicago. I kind of deliberately live here rather than on the coasts. Now, I don't have anything against the coasts. I very specifically said that I wanted to be in a place where I could easily sort of go to places like I outline in the book, like places in Iowa where election deniers are sort of getting power, travel pretty widely across the whole country to talk to people and to get sources and stories.
Well, again, America's heartland, Chicago, Illinois. And of course, so often we hear from the elites that the midsection of the country is referred to as flyover country. So it's nice to see that BBC is recognizing that the heartland is an important player in elections, number one. And number two, also from a logistics point of view, as you said, getting to the East Coast, getting to the West Coast is maybe a three and a half hour venture at most. So it looks like you're strategically in the middle, geographically speaking.
Yeah, that's right. It's very handy for what I have to do on a day-to-day basis.
Mike, your new book, Day of Reckoning, recounts how Donald Trump's base in the GOP, MAGA, is more committed to their candidate than ever before. Many of the familiar players, like the Proud Boys and Conspiracist, are back. But now there are new groups in MAGA, like Moms for Liberty, Capitol Rioters, and Christian Nationalists. Tell us how MAGA 2024 has evolved.
I took the approach from something that I've observed, not only in the last year and a half or 2 years that I've been here, but also previously, you know, ever since the Capitol riot of January the 6th, 2021. And it really is this. It's the fact that conspiracy, which is, you know, always been on the fringes of American politics, and certainly not limited to the Republican Party either. It's, if you talk to conspiracy researchers, people of all political persuasions do believe in conspiracy theories, and most people believe in more than one. It seems to have, particular type of conspiratorial thinking seems to have taken over the MAGA movement. And that's just as that movement is increasingly coming into the mainstream. You mentioned some statistics at the very beginning. Usually, particularly if following a loss in 2020, as I said, the Capitol riot, and then a poor performance compared to expectations in the midterm elections, you would think that that would kind of take the wind out of the sails of the MAGA movement and of Donald Trump. But bizarrely, it hasn't. Various reasons for that. But certainly, we're seeing this resurgence. I would be very cautious because I don't want to sort of say that everybody in the MAGA movement is a part of what some people have called a cult, or that they're all extremists, or that they're all far right. That's certainly not the case, and certainly there's a lot of internal dissent. There's various strands that are within that large movement, 4 in 10 Republicans, as you say. But certainly that idea of conspiracy is on the ascendance in there. Mm-hmm. And certainly the fringes are taking over and moving more into the mainstream. And of course, the best example of this is the continued salience to that movement of the idea that Donald Trump actually won the 2020 election after so many legal cases, after so much evidence being sort of picked over. There just is no real proof that there was a widespread voter fraud and that the result was in any way fraudulent or out of the ordinary. So in the book, I kind of look at the propaganda that has developed around that idea, the idea that there was, that Donald Trump somehow won the election, and the kind of flimsiness of the arguments that are made to kind of prop that up, which unfortunately continue to be a feature of American politics, and certainly, almost without a doubt, is going to be a major theme of the Trump campaign and of the 2024 election.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. Without a doubt, Joe Biden won the 2020 election, period. He won. He had the electoral votes. They were certified. He was sworn in on January 20th. He is the president of the United States legitimately. However, Bill Barr, who was the Attorney General under George Bush and also Donald Trump, he made this point. Again, he acknowledged that Joe Biden won, period. End of story. However, because of the unusual circumstances of the COVID pandemic in 2020, we had all 50 states making changes to their election process. And let me just give you an example here in California. Here in California, we have 22 million registered voters, one of the largest number of voters in the United States. And our legislature went ahead and changed the rules so that every single registered voter received a ballot in the mail. So 22 million ballots were sent out, and 17.5 million ballots were returned. So the good news was we had a very high participation in the presidential election here in California, but there were 4.5 million ballots that were sent out, and did they end up in the trash? Did they, you know, what happened to them? I'm not suggesting that they were fraudulently submitted, but I think a reasonable observer would say, you know, when you don't have tight control of the administration of elections, it sort of opens the door to suspicion. And that example from California, I think, is something that politicians who are supposed to be administering our elections and keeping them secure, they need to look at a stat like that and say, we don't want anyone to think, we don't want to leave any room for interpretation on election outcomes. So again, Joe Biden won fair and square, but I think some of our politicians need to tighten up the administration of elections. And I'm simply reiterating what Bob Barr had to say.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there are, I suppose, legitimate debates to be had about these kinds of things. The method of voting, for instance, you know, I don't think that there's any sort of particular virtue in using voting electronic machines, other than it allows people to sort of count faster. You know, there's obviously been problems that have been pointed out in the past about electronic voting machines and how they can potentially fail or, you know, might be susceptible to hacking and so forth. But like, I think you get to the crux of it when you say that there's no evidence that it actually sort of caused an actual problem in 2020. And this is sort of the key distinction. You know what I mean? I think, of course, there was a lot of change in voting in that year and a record turnout, near record turnout in terms of the people who sort of came out and voted. All of that sort of gets to another question, which is, how easy do you want it to make it to vote? And traditionally, I think it's interesting, obviously Democrats with a working class base and a base that includes many minority groups want to make it easier, because those groups tend to be discouraged from voting for various reasons or have other things in the way, like, you know, they have a job that requires them to work long hours, things like this. That might be shifting. That's not also a debate that we're having, you know, about, you know, how easy should it be to vote? You know, some countries, Australia is one, where it's mandatory to vote.
Right.
You go to the UK, where I lived for 20 years, and you will not find a machine in the ballot box. You will always find a paper with a pen in it or a pencil. These are all sort of debates that I suppose are probably pretty healthy to have in a democracy. When you throw in the impact of what is essentially conspiracy theory, we don't have those debates. You know, so in some ways, we don't have, we're not having those debates about the parameters and how easy it should be.
Right.
Because it's being clouded by this suspicion, and the suspicion that comes from the MAGA movement. And another point I would make is that it's very interesting how Republicans and Donald Trump have realized this is a problem. And it's a problem because if you consistently cast doubt on a form of voting, early voting, absentee voting, mail-in ballots, if you cast doubt on those, that requires you to get your supporters to come out on the day of election day and vote. Mm-hmm. And that's a very, in a close race, as we all think that it's going to be, bad weather or traffic or any number of things that come up on election day could be the difference between winning and losing in a state. So it's very curious to me and very interesting to see how there have been initiatives within the Republican Party to kind of reverse that constant stream of invective that's coming from Donald Trump and his supporters, who are telling people not to trust these methods of voting. There's a counter movement afoot. And whether they can overcome that powerful idea and the powerful suspicion that's been cast on the voting system could be a determining factor in November.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree with you more. None of us have any interest in casting aspersions on the election system. I mean, it's hard enough to accept a defeat or accept a win, but to not have the question thrown up of illegitimacy. So my only point is that, you know, administration of elections is important, but we're not here to discuss that. Administration of elections is important, and by the same token, accepting a result based on the rules that applied at the time the election took place, you have to accept it, period. Let's move on to who the players of MAGA were in 2020 and how MAGA has evolved and some of the new players and new issues that MAGA has seized on over the last 4 years.
Sure. Well, you know, I track a few different kinds of groups in the book. Proud Boys, as you mentioned, the Proud Boys have had their power base kind of dispersed by the fact that they can no longer really efficiently organize on social media, and their leaders, many of them, were put into prison for involvement in the Capitol riot. But interestingly, their locus, I suppose, has sort of shifted, and now they're at the forefront of anti-gay rights and anti-trans rights protests across the country. I go into a little bit about further groups that are sort of more extreme than the Proud Boys, groups that don't really like to talk to journalists, groups like Patriot Front and even more extreme groups that have really kind of taken a white nationalist tack. The groups that are so extreme that they are, you wouldn't necessarily consider them as part of the MAGA movement. They may have some sympathy with Trump's rhetoric about immigrants, for instance, but in general, they're very sort of removed from the political process. And of course, you mentioned the Moms for Liberty. They're part of a growing, you might call it a parents' rights movement. That's kind of how they like to describe themselves. But it's a very conservative movement that is dedicated to taking power at local levels. So they run for school boards, and they have hundreds of school boards offices throughout the country, mm-hmm. according to their own count. This is a very interesting phenomenon, I think, because it kind of grew up in the pandemic. It grew up as in terms of being against school closures, being against vaccine mandates and right. mask mandates, mm-hmm. but then has also sort of taken on this, I guess what you might call censorship or book banning, taking specific books, usually having to do with sex education or gender issues, out of school libraries. This is a very interesting thing because I think it sort of shows how these new sort of obsessions, I suppose, that are fueled by anti-vaccine conspiracy theories, maybe not expressed as anti-vaccine conspiracy theories, have also sort of merged with what you might think of as like old school conservative values and sort of, you know, worries about what students are learning about in schools. And they've taken a very aggressive stance.
Can I just jump in there,
yeah,
Mike?
Yeah, sure.
Question for you. In the previous iterations of MAGA, I considered MAGA to be very much a male-dominated movement. I'm not saying that it was exclusively male, but it the image of MAGA seemed to be more male-dominated, notwithstanding people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, etc. But with this Moms for Liberty and winning elections at the local school board level, is that something new for MAGA, the active involvement of women at the grassroots level and also their apparent success in winning local elections? Is that sort of a new turn for MAGA? Because Trump in 2020 and also today continues to be very weak when it comes to suburban women, to suburban moms, at getting them to vote for him. So is that a new strategy for MAGA?
You know, he's, I suppose, always had a certain proportion of women. And you point out that, yeah, his weakness, particularly amongst some suburban women in the past, that's always been an issue. And sort of how to address that has kind of always been an issue within the Republican Party. This organized thing, I think, is probably fairly new. And what's interesting is, like, when we talk about suburban moms, you know, these are the places where the Moms for Liberty are targeting. And I must say, getting a fair amount of pushback, too. So I cover a little bit the situation in Sarasota in Florida, which is a very sort of mixed county. It includes urban areas, suburban areas. It's one of the places, Florida in general, is where the Moms for Liberty sprang up. Mm-hmm. And it's one of their strongholds. And of course, you know, Florida is its own sort of unique political environment.
Right.
And has a lot of suburban area. While the... it's clear that I think, you know, Donald Trump will still continue to struggle at large. There are sort of these forces going on, and the suburbs seem to be sort of in play in a way that they weren't necessarily before. You know, the strategy of localism, also called the precinct strategy, is mm-hmm. a very fascinating thing that's developed, particularly since January the 6th. And it came from an idea, and it's been trumpeted by people like Steve Bannon, who's a close Trump advisor, of course, as a way of gaining power from the ground up, essentially very sort of grassroots. You know, in some ways, it's been very effective. We've seen this in a variety of different contexts and a variety of different places all over the country. And it's not limited to school boards either. So in the book, I go into a small county outside of Des Moines, Iowa, where somebody who was very into conspiracies about elections was appointed to be the county auditor. Sounds like a really boring job, right? But the county auditor in Iowa is responsible for local elections and the administration of local elections. Uh-huh. The people who in this gradually turning red county, once evenly split, now definitely Republican dominated. The people who were in charge of the voting system here in that county were shocked that somebody like that would have been appointed by the Republican town board. They managed to sort of push back and eventually get him recalled, and he lost the recall election. But it's, for me, that story is emblematic of how these sorts of strategies can work. And in particular, a lot of these people have targeted those kinds of jobs, the county auditor or the state secretary of state, people who have some sort of influence over the election process.
You mentioned the rise of parents' rights. We saw that in Florida with Ron DeSantis, and we've seen that with Moms for Liberty. Is this concept of parents' rights, is that a new flag-raising, flag-waving issue for MAGA?
It definitely, you know, in talking to people, I definitely sort of hear the themes of the parents' rights movement. I mean, to me, having, I suppose, grown up in this country and sort of, you know, credits to public schools for like giving me an education in this country,
sure.
It doesn't seem that different. It doesn't seem that different from some of the culture war issues that have been going on for decades. You know, it's about whether books are obscene or whether children should be taught particular things.
Well, to kill a
grafted
to
on ki- with some
to,
of this.
To Kill a Mockingbird, you know.
Right, actually, yes. I mean, you know, and you can probably name, you know, in the very sort of liberal area where I live, the library puts out a big shelf of the banned books, you know what I mean? And sort of says, I'm sure this is the same thing in San Francisco, right?
Oh,
read these
absolutely.
Books, please, because other people are banning them.
Exactly. Certainly here in San Francisco. And of course, you know, another issue from the 1960s before your time, but certainly part of my growing up here in the 1960s, was fluoride. And, you know, fluoride in the water became a big issue at the at school board meetings, where everybody, you know, at the time, putting fluoride in the water was supposed to be a health measure and keeping our teeth from decaying. And then, you know, there was a big protest movement about that it was affecting our brain or our attention span, etc. So yeah, you're absolutely right. The controversial issues, the kitchen table kind of concerns that American public has had around public education, around grammar school values and issues, they have been part of my experience growing up, your experience growing up, and you know, it seems like this parents' right movement is sort of a continuation of that. But on the other hand, parents' rights are now moving into, you know, governor's races and potentially the presidential race.
Yeah, and, you know, certainly they have the ability to really garner a popular movement. Because, you know, the one thing that we can all agree on is to protect children. We may not agree on the right way to do that, but it's very visceral. And it also appeals, of course, to, you know, across the spectrum. But if you're trying to get the votes of suburban women, a good way to do it is to say, hey, look, I'm out looking for the best for your children. The perhaps the new and interesting part of this whole thing is the medical aspect. I mean, in the 1990s, I remember reading a textbook. You mentioned the fluoride. And I remember picking up a history textbook and outlining sort of, you know, various political movements. And the John Birch Society was against the fluoridation of water. Yes. And in the 1990s, it seemed so completely bizarre and really kind of like a relic of the past, even though it wasn't that long before that the John Birch Society in the 1960s was at its height. And these kinds of medical issues are coming back in the form of the anti-vaccination unit movement, to some degree sort of expressed as I say, like an anti-mask mandate movement or against mandates, right? Yes. Even that is a little bit far out from my experience, I'm sure yours, because, you know, many states have had vaccine mandates of various types for various diseases for some time, and it's been very uncontroversial for a long time.
Yes. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when polio vaccine first came in. And again, I was a little kid. I got my shot. My brothers and sisters got their shots. That was it. There was no discussion in my family, in my household, about whether or not we should or shouldn't get the polio vaccine. In fact, at the time, for anyone who would have said no to polio vaccine, they would have thought they were crackpots.
Right. And, you know, it's not necessarily a popular movement, but the anti-vax machinery and movement has been very successful in pushing its propaganda, really, during the COVID pandemic.
Yes.
So they really took advantage of that. We saw this, and it was before the time I was here in the U.S., but certainly we were looking at this stuff online, and not just in the U.S., but around the world. They were gearing up, even before there was a COVID vaccine, to take advantage of the fact that there was a lot of money being poured into pharmaceutical research, pharmaceutical companies, and that the vaccine was going to be come out, and many vaccines were going to come out. Many billions of people were going to be taking them, and they really sort of capitalized on this. And if my argument doesn't sound convincing, you only need to look at a major candidate who is now running perhaps the biggest third-party candidacy for decades. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. is likely would not be running for president had he not been running an anti-vaccine organization for many years, which exploded in terms of funding and popularity during the COVID pandemic.
And of course, his original anti-vaccine stance was based on his concerns about autism. And again, those concerns about autism being caused by childhood infant vaccinations, those theories have been addressed, they've been debunked, etc. But he continued to push on that. And then when COVID came along, that was a base on which he could build. But incidentally, Robert Kennedy Jr. has just qualified for the California ballot. He will be on the ballot in California. Now, it's not to say that that he has any chance of winning in California, nor is it to say that he would be able to gain enough votes to throw California into the Trump column. But nevertheless, even here in San Francisco, I've started to see Kennedy 24 bumper stickers. I saw one up in the darkest blue area of Sonoma County. I even saw a table for Kennedy 2024 over on the campus at San Francisco State University here in San Francisco, which was right next to the Gaza protest. So go figure.
That is interesting. I wonder if they knew his staunch support for Israel, which he has not really hidden. I mean, his campaign, I've now gone to several Kennedy events and written several stories about the campaign. I think that he'll probably qualify for most, if not all, state ballots. Of course, who he draws support from is a very, very complicated question. And I don't think it's very easy to answer. And I don't think we'll probably have an answer until after Election Day, maybe far after Election Day. His hodgepodge of ideas isn't limited to vaccines and sort of health misinformation and whatnot. You know, he has a variety of other stances. Mm-hmm. But he's certainly going to have an impact on the race.
Now, coming back to MAGA, one of the big issues for MAGA in the 2016 race was build the wall, immigration. And immigration continues to be one of Biden's weakest issues. And there seem to be, you know, that seems to be an area where Biden is losing votes. Where does MAGA stand on that immigration issue? Is it the same as it was in 2016? Or has their position on immigration evolved?
You mentioned that, you know, the President Biden is not very sort of popular on this issue, and it's certainly a problem, and certainly a problem that Donald Trump recognizes. I don't think there's a whole lot of difference between that and in 2016 or 2020. In terms of the sort of overall theme that I cover, certainly you will hear more conspiratorial thinking. So, for instance, it's very common that you'll hear that, you know, perhaps George Soros is funding various groups to push people over the border and various sort of offshoots of those kinds of conspiracy theories. I think those are more common. I guess you don't necessarily need to believe that there's some sort of secret plot in order to see that there's some sort of issue at the border that needs to be dealing with. So right. in some respect, there's a sort of more reality-based thinking when it comes to that. Now, I mean, there's also, you know, a lot of sort of spun statistics, let's put it like that, and a complicated reality on the ground. But certainly there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of change. And it's probably something that I think the Trump campaign thinks that they can definitely capitalize on. Mm-hmm. I've been to migrant shelters here in Chicago. Well, you know, while it's a big city and one that's very familiar with waves of migration over years, it's something that's very unusual. Even in a big city where there's just thousands or tens of thousands of migrants who are coming directly from the border, sent mostly by the government of Texas, it's definitely going to be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about this other subgroup, Christian nationalist? Is that something? Is that a newer group to MAGA? I mean, of course, the evangelicals, I guess, had been part of the MAGA movement, but this group, Christian nationalist, is that something new? Is that a new twist and a different kind of a different emphasis for MAGA?
I think it's something that's always been there in the background. And there's always, if you sort of turn this back, I did some reporting, which actually didn't make it into the book, unfortunately, because it was around the Iowa caucuses in January and the book was already finished by then. But I think it's very interesting and very sort of telling. If you look at 2016, you know, a lot of evangelical voters are very skeptical of Donald Trump. You know, here's this sort of divorced playboy from Manhattan, not a sort of a natural fit with your average evangelical voter. But the whole concept of evangelical, being evangelical, has kind of developed since then. And, you know, the experts who study this in more detail tell me that in some ways it's kind of fused with a nationalistic idea and also with support for Donald Trump and the MAGA movement. There's a rise in particularly white evangelicals in the middle of the country who actually do not go to church. And that sounds very strange when you think about it, because that would appear to be like, you know, a core part of your identity if you're an evangelical Christian would be your church. A sizable proportion don't regularly attend church services. That idea of a community where your pastor and your fellow church congregants form your community and your worldview has been gradually eroded. And the you know, these sort of new evangelicals are looking more for their sense of community to their political leaders. Of course, that includes Donald Trump, to their media outlets. And of course, that includes right-wing media and Republican-leaning media across the country. That's a very sort of interesting dynamic. It means that, you know, Trump has obtained, you know, solid support in places like Iowa, where he, you know, struggled previously. It has some big implications in, you know, states like Wisconsin and Michigan. It's a very curious phenomenon.
You mentioned early on the Patriot Front. Now, I don't recall that particular group in the old MAGA, but is that a newer group? And is that just kind of a reformulation of the Proud Boys, or is that something new? And given their, you alluded to their avoidance of talking to the media, is the Patriot Front something new? Where does it come from? And is that a group that we should be watching more closely?
Well, I think so. I mean, Patriot Front basically came out of other groups that sort of splintered after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville in 2017 and that horrific, violent weekend. It has become one of the premier groups on the far right in terms of spreading propaganda. Occasionally, they have marches or counter protests, but they generally tend to operate in the shadows and not particularly violently, but more spreading anti-Semitic, anti-Native American, anti-minority propaganda. They are explicitly want a white nation. Mm. In fact, according to the ADL, they are responsible for the vast majority of anti-Semitic propaganda in terms of like leaflets, posters, and messages and so forth. You know, there's been a spike in that kind of thing in recent years. And this one group, even though it has relatively few members, perhaps a few hundred, no more than a couple of thousand, I would think. So, you know, it's definitely something to look out for. I mentioned that it's not sort of a mainstream MAGA, and certainly they are not sort of super involved in mainstream Republican politics, mm-hmm. or, you know, going to be at the front row of a Trump rally like the Proud Boys have been in the past. But certainly they have some dovetailed interests, and they will like Donald Trump's more extreme rhetoric on immigrants and the way that he manages to say things that politicians don't seem to be able to say without incurring a political cost. The other interesting thing I would say about a group like Patriot Front is that they have prompted a very strange reaction from the MAGA movement and the right wing of the Republican Party. And it's this. A lot of people, Marjorie Taylor Greene and other sort of prominent Republicans, have accused the federal government of actually being behind this group. And there's absolutely no evidence for this, none whatsoever as far as I can see. But it's part of a larger conspiracy theory that somehow Republicans and the MAGA movement are being tricked, being made to look bad, that there are that the real sort of driver of extremism is the FBI or, you know, even the security services. It's a very sort of bizarre conspiracy theory that has taken hold all throughout the right wing, you know, not even limited to the far right mm-hmm. of the Republican Party. It means that they don't necessarily condemn these groups. They simply think that they're sort of fake or somehow a front group. It's a real indication of the level of paranoia that we're dealing with.
Well, Mike, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are your closing thoughts? And are there any other new players in that front row of the MAGA audience that we should be focused on?
A lot of the groups that were established at the time of the 2020 election and the Capitol riot have, like I say, splintered. And, you know, some have gone away completely. Others have changed their focus. Others have had trouble organizing. I think more than any one particular group, though, or any one particular sort of movement, it's probably useful to think of it like this. There's no sense in guarding against the, you know, what we saw in terms of what happened at Charlottesville or what happened at the Capitol on January the 6th. I simply don't think that there's a huge risk that there's a repeat of that because of the fractiousness and the changing nature of the people involved and whatnot. Mm-hmm. That's not to say that there won't be a risk of violence or severe disorder around the election. I think probably we can all agree that it's going to be quite high for various reasons, not limited to people who are on the right or the MAGA movement, but you know, certainly they're definitely a concerning group to be looking at here. I make the point that the title of the book, Day of Reckoning, is almost a poking, trying to poke a hole in the worldview of the people who are most invested in these conspiracy theories about voting and whatnot. Because they are the ones who are saying that the election day in November is the ultimate, that it's part of some sort of final battle for American history and democracy. I think we could probably all use to maybe just take a deep breath. Elections are politics, of course, but politics is much more than elections. We'll all wake up the day after election day on a Wednesday morning and, you know, who knows, we may not know the result, but the world will continue to spin. There are groups that are prepared to take advantage of that heightened sense of paranoia and that heightened sense of conspiracy. And those are the ones that I think are probably most dangerous and worth looking out for.
Well, Mike, where can our listeners buy a copy of Day of Reckoning?
So, I mean, hopefully in any good bookstore, your local bookstore. I hear there's a site, I think it's named after a jungle in Brazil, that you can also buy one. It comes out from Pluto Press. So if you look at the Pluto Press website, it's available there. And you can, I mean, you can find me online. I'm on Twitter at M. Wendling. My email is on there. I'm on all the other social media outlets too. So people have thoughts. I love to hear from people who read my articles on the BBC website. That's very easy to find. And I'll be regularly reporting there and on other BBC outlets throughout the campaign and beyond.
Listeners, I thoroughly recommend Day of Reckoning to you, and to make sure that you buy a copy of it, because a lot has changed with MAGA. MAGA, no question, is going to become an issue in the presidential campaign, and there are some new players here. Mike has done terrific research here, right on the ground, in great BBC tradition, so I thoroughly recommend that you get a copy of this book, familiarize yourself with some of the new faces in the MAGA lineup, and some of the not-so-new faces in the MAGA lineup. And again, Mike, thank you for your thorough research. And this is kind of a handbook for anyone who's really interested in who the players in the 2024 election are going to be. And MAGA, without a question, is going to be one of them. You've told us where our listeners can follow up with you, Mike. Any closing thoughts? Any new initiatives coming down the road?
Well, you know, I'll be looking at a number of different things. I mentioned about voting, the concerns that Republicans have around voting. Obviously, we're an international news organization. I will be looking at the role of foreign countries, and you can probably guess which ones, but we're definitely investigating some of that and the role of foreign actors who are trying to influence the election. Most of the reporting that I hope to do is along the lines of what's in the book, which is, you know, talking to ordinary people of all sorts, including ones who are trying to, as we've been discussing, influence things from the bottom up. So you can expect more stories like that. And hopefully some uncovered gems that, you know, we don't know about now, but I'll be reporting on it in the future.
Mike Wendling of the BBC, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 522. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms with listeners in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.